minds of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, June 30th, 2025. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Ellie Mistal, justice correspondent and columnist at The Nation magazine, author of Bad Law, 10 Popular Laws That Are Ruining America. Also on the program today, Senate Republican moves the big disaster bill into the Voterama. People are calling it the worst legislation, arguably, in a lifetime. North Carolina Republican Senator Tom Tillis is the first Republican casualty, slams the bill for devastating health care, announces he will not be seeking re-election. Senate reconciliation bill, also a kill shot, destroying thousands of solar and wind businesses and projects. U.S. announces a date to deport nearly 500,000 Haitians after setting a temporary protected status deadline in September. Israel steps up attacks on Gaza, bombing at least 72 people, killing them. Settlers in the West Bank are rioting. Trump administration building a centralized citizen data system. And as med schools renew focus on measles and infectious diseases, no one seems to know who's running the CDC. Nearly 300 EPA employees, half of more have signed that publicly, issue a declaration of dissent about the new EPA directives. World central banks to meet to discuss the end of dollar domination as Trump causes a massive investment and capital outflow to EU and Asia. And lastly, Trump threatens Mamdani with federal funds to be cut off unless he behaves. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks so much for joining us. Emma is out, still on honeymoon. It's been, I mean, over 3 days. What do you do on a honeymoon that long? Nevertheless, what's that?
Yeah, check Twitter, you go on Twitter.
How do you, I don't understand. I just don't, I mean, she will be back next Monday, and just a house cleaning. We will, of course, be taking a Friday off this week. A lot to get to. The Senate reconciliation bill, which we have been telling you about for months, weeks now, passed the senators stayed over the weekend. When there's an opportunity to immiserate millions of people and enrich very wealthy people, these senators will go to the mat. They will give you 120%. And they did it this weekend. They lost two votes on essentially moving the bill forward. In other words, ending discussion or cloture. The two votes they lost were Tom Tillis from North Carolina not super shocking, although wouldn't have been the first one I guessed. And Rand Paul didn't want to vote for this because it includes a debt ceiling increase. There were other senators who were prepared to vote against it, but when they saw that it actually would kill the bill if they voted against it, they didn't do it.
Do you see Josh Hawley's emo populism that he regrets that some of his constituents are going to be thrown off insurance? But
I think we have a clip of that. Don't we have a clip of that?
Fix it later of Hawley.
Yeah, we should. I think that's in the. But yes, we saw that. It turns out that Josh Hawley, his populism does not run as deeply as he did when folks were attacking the Capitol on January 6th. Nevertheless, the bill, the cloture passed. That means it goes on to debate. But what the Democrats in the Senate did is said that the staffers in the Senate, the secretary, had to read the bill. Usually this is skipped, but the bill is over 950 pages long. And nobody had really seen it for more than 10, 12 hours by the time it was voted upon. And so the Democrats called for it to be read. It was read all through the night until Sunday at some time. And then, as of this morning, the Votorama begins, which is essentially with a reconciliation bill. You cannot prevent amendments from being offered. And so what happens in these instances is that both the Republicans and the Democrats begin to offer amendments so that they can Republicans so that they can mitigate the disaster this bill is going to do politically to them, or at least that's the theory. I voted to have an amendment and it was shot down. I voted to, make it possible for there to be green energy. I shot it down. I don't know that there would be any that would say that. Although I think Tom Tillis had a big problem with the green energy aspects of this. And then the Democrats keep adding amendments, some of which are votes that Republicans don't want to have to take, but will. But at the end of the day, this bill itself is so incredibly unpopular, and people haven't even actually begun to feel the impact. If you were thinking about putting solar panels on your house and anticipating that 30% tax cut, then you were thinking, maybe, you know what, I can't afford it this year, but maybe in a year or two I can. That tax cut is going to end at the end of this year. If you are a solar company that started up a year or two ago and thought, I'm going to be able to make this business work because the government is essentially subsidizing with these tax cuts the rollout of this technology. If you're a massive wind farm, and you were thinking of building, or you were building, or you are selling products to other people. I mean, this is going to devastate thousands of businesses. If you were Elon Musk and trying to salvage your failing electric vehicle business, you're screwed. And apparently he's a little bit upset about things. But the list goes on and on. SNAP cuts. Millions of people will go without food assistance, and it'll get even worse in a recession. Here is Harry Enten on CNN. And understand, this is how badly people are perceiving this bill before they actually feel the pain itself.
How do Americans feel about the Big Beautiful Bill?
Yeah, if we're talking about adjectives, how about they think it's awful, they think it's horrible, and to quote our colleague Charles Barkley, terrible, terrible, terrible. What are we talking about here? Well, let's take a look at the net favorable rating on the Big Beautiful Bill. I don't just got one poll for you, Omar. I got five of them, and the net favorable rating minus 19 points, Washington Post, minus 20 points, Pew Research Center, Fox, minus 21, Quinnipiac University, minus 26, KFF, minus 29. You don't have to be a mathematical genius to know that when the net favorable rating of your bill is somewhere between minus 19 and minus 29 points, that it is not a positive bill as viewed by the American public. The American public at this particular point hate the big, beautiful bill. As far as they're concerned, it's not a big, beautiful bill. It's a big, bad bill.
It is a big, bad bill. And it is amazing to me that you have mainstream media still referring to it as Big Beautiful Bill. I mean, it was such a... I can't believe that worked. I just started calling it... The next bill we're going to try and pass is going to be Good Thing Bill.
The Big Beautiful Trump is King Bill.
Good Bill. You wanted it. You got it. Trump is King Bill.
And also the best businessman in American history, Bill.
Of course, there's huge upward distribution in this bill. I mean, this is a bill that is pushing $930 billion worth of Medicaid cuts and providing $910 billion tax breaks for corporations. And huge upward distribution in terms of taxes across the board. We know the vast majority, both as a real dollar amount and as a percentage of tax cuts, go to the very wealthy. Here is a taste of what Republicans who vote for this bill know. Tom Tillis is going to go in there. He still wants to have a future in Republican politics, mind you. So he's pretending that Donald Trump doesn't understand what he's doing, that he's being tricked by dumb advisors in the White House. No one's telling him the truth. And he's being fooled. Now, listen to Tom Tillis here. Understand he was up for re-election in 2026. He is no longer going to be up for re-election. The rest of the Republicans are basically saying, we are going to rob the bank and we get in the getaway car. Even if we lose the House and the Senate, this is going to have such a negative impact on this country. They just don't think that any of this stuff can be reversed. And on some level, they're going to be right. Here's Tom Tillis.
Between the state-directed payments and the cuts scheduled in this bill, there's a reduction of state-directed payments. And then there's the reduction of the provider tax. They can't find a hole in my estimate. So what they told me is that, yeah, it's rough, but North Carolina's used the system. They're going to have to make it work. All right. So what do I tell 663,000 people in 2 years or 3 years when President Trump breaks his promise by pushing them off of Medicaid because the funding's not there anymore, guys? I think when the White House, which is advising the president, are not telling him that the effect of this bill is to break a promise. And you know, the last time I saw a promise broken around health care, with respect to my friends on the other side of the aisle, it's when somebody said, if you like your health care, you can keep it. If you like your doctor, you can keep it. We found out that wasn't true.
Pause it for a second.
That made
Now, I just need to, because I had to go live through this era, make a correction to what Tom Tillis is saying. Obviously, now, he can't get up there and say either A, the president is an inveterate liar, which we all know is the case. And in fact, in this instance, he lied against the people that support him. Or B, he is a complete moron and has no idea what he's pushing, which, you know, arguably, they don't have to be separate things.
Right.
They're not mutually exclusive. But this point about you can keep your doctor if you want, Private health insurance does not let you do that. Every year, I can't remember when it is, sometime I think around now, actually, you get notice your doctor's no longer in plan. And if you go to them now, you get like only 25%, coverage. And so when Obama said that, he should have had an asterisk next to it, you know, to the extent that private insurance lets you do that anyways, right. Which, of course, they don't. But that's their talking point. And Tom Tillis still has to go to the country club once he quits the Senate. Continue.
You're back in the circle of trust.
Like your doctor, you can keep it. We found out that wasn't true. That made me the second Republican Speaker of the House since the Civil War, ladies and gentlemen, because we betrayed the promise to the American people. 2 years later, 3 years later, it actually made me a U.S. Senator, because in 2010, it had just been proposed. And just anticipation of what was going to happen was enough to have a sea change election that swept Republicans into the majority for the second time in 100 years. Now, Republicans are about to make a mistake on health care and betraying a promise. It is inescapable that this bill in its current form will betray the very promise that Donald J. Trump made in the Oval Office or in the cabinet room when I was there with finance, where he said we can go after waste, fraud, and abuse on any programs. Now,
okay. Now, the irony is the Medicaid, the 630,000 that he's talking about that are going to lose their Medicaid possibly under this, likely, they are on Medicaid because of the Affordable Care Act, which expanded Medicaid. Now, of course, he's not going to tell anybody that, but he needed an analogy. And the fact of the matter is, once kicked in and people understood, at least it wasn't so much made health insurance significantly affordable. Well, it certainly didn't make it affordable for everybody who was not in the Affordable Care Act. But for everybody who is not part of the exchanges, which is about 11 million Americans, they all got an upgrade on the quality of their health insurance insofar as there was no rescission, there was no lifetime caps, there was no annual caps. That's the patient protection part of the bill. But let's not lose sight of what we're talking about here. This bill is a disaster. Millions are going to get cut from SNAP. Millions are going to get cut from Medicaid. So much of the tiny steps that we've taken in terms of renewable energy is going to go exactly the opposite way with subsidies for oil and gas. Someone just asked, why aren't Democrats filibustering this bill? This is a reconciliation bill. It's a special type of bill that only needs 50 plus one in the Senate. And they got 51 votes in the Senate. There are specifics that got wiped out of the bill because of it being a reconciliation bill. But that's what you're missing. Also, I don't know if that was a bolo tie. It could have been the microphone. I think it's the microphone. I can't imagine you go out wearing a bolo tie like that for your big swan song speech.
I didn't know North Carolina was a bolo tie place. I associate that with like Montana.
I feel like it was the microphone. Nevertheless, Tom Tillis just basically told us the Republicans know this may be incredibly politically costly and they don't care. They just robbed the bank. And they're getting in the driveway car. They don't care. We'll talk more about this, obviously, in the fun half and tomorrow. In a moment, we're going to be talking to Ellie Mistel about the absolute crap show that the Supreme Court was in this term. This is what you get. This is what we all get. A couple of words from our sponsors. few decades ago, private citizens used to be largely private. What changed? The internet. Think about everything you browsed, searched for, watched, or tweeted. Now imagine all that data being crawled, collected, aggregated by data brokers into a permanent public record, your record. Having your private life exposed for others to see was something that only celebrities used to worry about. But in an era when everybody's online, everybody's a public figure. To keep my data private, I turn to today's sponsor, ExpressVPN. Visit expressvpn.com/majority and you can get an extra 4 months free. One of the easiest ways for data brokers to track you is through your device unique IP address, which also reveals information about your location. With ExpressVPN, your IP address is hidden. That makes it much more difficult for data brokers to monitor, track, and monetize your private online activity. ExpressVPN also encrypts 100% of your network traffic to keep your data safe from hackers when you're on public Wi-Fi. ExpressVPN works on all your devices, phone, laptop, tablet, you name it. Just one tap one button to turn it on and you're protected. It's that easy. For me, it's all about the encryption. It's all about keeping that data secure. I don't want to go on a public Wi-Fi system like at an airport or in a mall or at the... I've been on one at a... escape room. Saul likes to do escape rooms. And you don't want to feel like, whoa, if I send any information, somebody can hack this stuff. That, to me, is the biggest issue. You can also, obviously, you hide your IP. You can spoof other IPs. But for me, that's what it is. You can protect your online privacy today by visiting expressvpn.com/majority. That's ExpressVPN.com/majority, and you can get an extra 4 months free. ExpressVPN.com/majority. Also on the program today, or I should say sponsoring the program, adventure. Adventure in the form of you learning a new language. The world is literally your oyster. When you learn a new language, and it gives you an option of escaping quickly and knowing what you're saying as you leave this country. And I'm talking an easy way for you to learn is Babbel. Babbel is honestly a super easy way to learn a language. It comes in very like bite-sized lessons. So you can do this when you're on a small commute. You can do a lot of it on a long commute. You can do it when you're walking. You can do it in between, making dinner for the kids, etc. You can start speaking a new language with confidence thanks to Babbel. Babbel's conversation-based technique that quickly teaches you useful words and phrases about the things you actually talk about in the real world. There's over a dozen languages available to learn at your own pace, so you can achieve your goals with material tailored to your individual proficiency level, your particular interests, and, of course, how much time you have. I mean, you can sit down. You could do an hour's worth at any given time, but if you can only do 10, then you can do 10. It's handcrafted by over 200 language experts. Babbel's lessons are voiced by real native speakers and built with science-backed cognitive tools like spaced repetition, interactive features to fit any type of learning style. Babbel's got tips and tools for learning a new language that are approachable and accessible. It's like having a private tutor in your pocket without the uncomfortability of having a private tutor in your pocket. They have interactive dialogue, so you can actually like engage in a conversation. You can do this right off the bat. And they have speech recognition to make sure you're getting the pronunciation just right. Of course, that is a big problem for me. I can't even do it in English, pronounce things well. Pronounce things? Pronounce. I can't. Staying motivated to learn a new language has never been easier thanks to real-time feedback. They got progress trackers. Only 10 to 15 minutes a day on Babbel's mobile app or website. One study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester of college. 16 million subscriptions sold. Babbel's 14 award-winning language courses are backed by a 20-day money-back guarantee. So get starting talking with Babbel. I want you to learn another language, so I'm teaming up with Babbel to give you gift you 55% off subscriptions at babbel.com/majority. Get up to 55%. Babbel.com/majority, spelled B-A-B-B-E-L. B-A-B-B-E-L. Babbel.com/majority. Babbel.com/majority. Rules and restrictions apply. Also, we will put the info in the podcast and YouTube descriptions. Got to take a quick break. When we come back, Ellie Mistel, justice correspondent, columnist at The Nation, and author of Bad Law, 10 Popular Laws That Are Ruining America. All right, we got a little bit of delay with Ellie Mistel. He'll be with us shortly. In the meantime, let's take a look at more senators talking about this behemoth of literally what could be the worst legislation in a generation. I'm talking about this reconciliation bill, which cuts taxes dramatically for the wealthy. It distributes money upwards to the rich. It cuts millions upon millions of people off of health care. It cuts millions of people off of food assistance. It cuts all of the subsidies that we have passed during the Biden administration to help wind and solar energy get a toehold. It provides subsidies to oil companies, still allows for the threatening of withholding of federal funds if states pass any AI legislation. I mean, it goes on and on and on. Here's Josh Hawley, the famed Republican populist, who has been talking over and over and over again how he will not support a bill that would cut this many people off of Medicaid. His own voters are on Medicaid. He is not going to support this bill unless it's time to vote on it.
We can't be cutting health care for working people and for poor people in order to constantly give special tax treatment to corporations and other entities. And we've delayed that in this bill. But it will, unless we take further changes or take further steps, it will happen in future years. And I just don't oppose to this. We, if we're going to be a working class party, we've got to protect working people. And I just, the Medicaid stuff in here, I think is bad.
Okay. All right. And I want you to know, this is not video from a year ago. It's not even video from 2 months ago. This is video from yesterday after he voted for the bill.
Emo populism. He's sad about it.
He's not going to support it in an emotional way.
Yeah, he's not emotionally available for it.
He's not like, if the bill comes to me and says, I need to borrow $10, I'm going to say no. But I am going to vote to pass it into law and remind my colleagues that I am not emotionally supporting this bill. It's upsetting to me, this bill. It's upsetting to me that I had to vote for this bill.
Oh, I should almost get credit for not voting for it.
I just want my constituents to know that it was that much harder for me to vote for this because I'm not in favor of it.
I know all the bad things about it, and then I still voted for it.
A lot of people can vote for bills they support. That's the easy way of doing it. But I'm voting for bills that I don't support.
That's what it means to be a mighty man of valor.
You don't even have to play the audio sound anymore. You've basically adopted the voice. Here is Senator Patty Miller from Democrat from Washington State.
Murray.
Sorry. This is Patty Murray. When was this? Was this just after it passed? This is Patty Murray outlining the implication of these tax cuts. Oh, and I should also add, in addition to all of the other parliamentary questions, the Republicans unilaterally and somehow skipped over the parliamentarian in this one instance, and I don't know why there hasn't been more said about this, and have decided for the first time in the legislative history of this country that the baseline numbers for the taxes that we are bringing in when this bill ends reflect the existing tax code. In other words, these tax cuts that we're operating under now passed in a similar reconciliation bill 10 years ago. And you cannot, under the rules of a reconciliation, pass any legislation that will impact the deficit 10 years out. And so this bill was meant to sunset. And they're pretending it's not, so that the baseline of tax cuts that they're providing, they save $4 trillion in their accounting. So the fact that this adds so much to the deficit is on top of another number that is almost like double that. Here's Patty Murray.
As a senator from Washington.
Mr. President, I've been here a long time. Not only have I been the budget chair, I am the longest serving Democrat on that committee. And in my 33 years here in the United States Senate, things have never, never worked this way, where one party so egregiously ignores precedent, process, and the parliamentarian, and does that all in order to wipe away trillions of dollars of costs for a bill that could just be the most expensive legislation this body ever passes. Forget Senate procedure for a minute. Math, Mr. President, has never worked that way. I taught preschool, and I'll tell you, even our littlest kids knows the difference between a trillion and zero. It doesn't take a preschooler to tell you they're using magic math, or that you can't just ignore the rules you don't like. How many times have my colleagues cried about the debt? How many times have they told me, I know you want to invest in childcare, Patty, but we got to get this budget under control. But now that it's tax cuts for billionaires and corporations, suddenly the budget doesn't matter anymore. Suddenly the rules do not matter anymore. Suddenly a couple trillion goes away with a sprinkle of fairy dust. And
to be fair, it's not so sudden. The Republicans have been acting like this for decades, literally decades. She may not remember when Mitch McConnell said, we're just not gonna allow the president to nominate a Supreme Court justice this year. We'll skip on that. Or when the Republicans fired the parliamentarian in George W. Bush's era to pass tax cuts. This is not sudden. They do this every time.
Pattern.
All right, we'll talk more about this later in the program. We're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Ellie Mistel. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Emma Vigeland out today for her honeymoon. Well, whatever. Also, it's a pleasure to have joining us Ellie Mistel. He is the justice correspondent, columnist at The Nation, author of Bad Law, 10 Popular Laws That Are Ruining America. Ellie, how's it going?
Congratulations to Emma. I hope her honeymoon is going fantastically. I brought my PlayStation on my honeymoon.
Oh, you did? Emma brought Twitter. So,
which was awesome. I had everything I needed for my wife and had, when she was busy, just had my own entertainments. It was great. So I hope she's having a great time. I'm doing terrible, right? We are living in a kind of a fascist authoritarian state with a theocratic court, and last Friday was the court's last day, and they released a slew of truly law-breaking, mind-breaking, terrible opinions, and some were worse than I even expected them to be. Right, you always expect the Supreme Court to do the wrong thing, but there's a degree of destruction that they can go for, and they went for the most destructive, the most chaotic versions that they could. It was really bad.
I have to say that as someone who reads a lot of folks like yourself who write about the Supreme Court and have been doing so for, 10, 15 years quite religiously, I don't remember a series of cases where the opinions drafted were considered to be so shoddy, like not even based upon made up theories, just sort of like aligning over like their problem, just ignoring it as if like it's like, well, nobody's gonna ask, nobody can question me anyways. There's a quality to what they're producing now out of this six that has a definitive like,
respect me, boo.
Exactly. Like, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, no, we are in the straight culture war Supreme Court. And what we saw at the end of the term was the Supreme Court kind of, it's the kind of bizarro Michael Corleone, this is the day that we handle all family business. And it was just culture war decision after culture war decision where they're not even doing law anymore, right? Like the idea that, there are statutes and precedents and they have to analyze them. They're far beyond the pale of doing that. They are just imposing their culture war decisions upon the rest of us with no regard for precedent. And they've been doing that for a while. I think the reason why the people that you're talking about, people like me, the reason why we're writing the way we are right now is that for a lot of them, there was this hope, right, that the Supreme Court would be kind of the final boss of the Trump administration, that it would be the thing that would slow down the Trump administration and his unconstitutional illegal activities. Sam, as you know, I have been saying from the jump that the courts will not save us, that the Supreme Court, I've always been saying the Supreme Court was most likely to rubber stamp Trump's illegal executive actions. Now they're doing that. And now I think a lot of other people are kind of catching up to the fact that, well, perhaps you thought the court was going to help you, but it ain't. Right. And this is what it looks like when it ain't.
All right. Let's talk about this Planned Parenthood Medicaid ruling from the other day. This essentially is a state suing and saying that there is no right for a Medicaid patient to choose to get care from its whatever provider they have access to, essentially, who will take Medicaid. It's
so the thing about the Planned Parenthood case is that whenever you put Planned Parenthood in your case title, everybody thinks it's about abortion. Like everybody, and everybody kind of knows that the Supreme Court hates women, hates abortions, is not going to go for it. And this case does have something to do with abortion, but this is the issue where Planned Parenthood does a lot of things that are not abortion, right? They just provide a lot of care, a lot of health care for women and their lady parts. Like that's what Planned Parenthood does, and abortion is just one aspect of that, right? So in 2018, South Carolina, the state of South Carolina, passed a law saying that you could not use federal funds that include Medicaid for at any provider that also provides abortions, right? For a long time, there's been this thing called the Hyde Amendment since 1976 that says you can't use federal funds for abortion, including Medicaid funds. I think that's a terrible law. I literally wrote about it in my book about bad laws. I think the Hyde Amendment is terrible. This has nothing to do with the Hyde Amendment. Right. This has nothing to do with federal funding of abortion. That issue is settled incorrectly, in my view, but settled. Right. This is South Carolina saying, now, if you also provide abortions, you can't use Medicaid funds for anything else. Right. So what is that trying to do? It is trying to force medical institutions to not provide any abortion services at all, even in states where they are allowed to provide abortions, because if they do, they will get cut off in federal funding, including Medicaid, right? So that's like what's happening at 30,000 feet. But on the ground, right, in the actual case, what this was about was a woman who used Planned Parenthood for regular gynecological services that had nothing to do with abortion. And South Carolina says saying, no, you can't choose your own doctor, right? Well, the Medicaid Act has a very clear provision that allows for freedom of choice. It says that if you are a state that accepts Medicaid funds, which South Carolina, like, never forget, folks, South Carolina still wants the money. They still want the federal money, and they're going to do everything they can to keep the federal money. So South Carolina wants the federal money, and it says that if you take this federal money in the form of Medicaid reimbursements, then you have to let people on Medicaid choose whatever service provider they like for any medical treatment that the service provider is able to provide, right, is qualified to give, right? That is in the statute, right? But the Supreme Court says, actually, no, it's not. Neil Gorsuch, writing for the 6-3 majority, invented ambiguity in the freedom of choice provision of the Medicaid Act, saying that actually Congress did not intend to include freedom of choice as a right in the Medicaid Act, even though they say freedom of choice in the Medicaid Act. It is a classic kind of version of textualism making things up as they go along, right? Like people think that textualism is the most simple way of interpreting the law because you just read the sentence and what does it common sense say? But like the whole point of textualism from a conservative side is to pretend that there's ambiguity in very clear statements when that ambiguity helps your side, and pretend that there's no ambiguity in ambiguous statements when having no ambiguity helps your side. It is a method of interpretation that expands or contracts to fit whatever the Republicans on the Supreme Court want that day. And what Neil Gorsuch wanted that day was to take the freedom of choice provision out of the Medicaid Act. And so he invented some bullcrap, where he said, oh, it's actually not at all clear what Congress wanted to do. So what can we do? There is no freedom of choice for Medicaid, right? So it is about abortion, but it's not really about abortion, right? Or maybe it's the other way around. It's not really about abortion, but it is about abortion, right? Neil Gorsuch wanted to allow South Carolina to not only kill Planned Parenthood, but kill any other abortion provider in its state. And he wanted to take the freedom of choice away from poor women on Medicaid.
And doesn't it also, I mean, my understanding is that the precedent here in terms of the question of, can I sue an entity that is inhibiting a federal right that has been granted to me by statute or by theoretically the Constitution? And that in 2023 in the Talevsky case.
I never know how to pronounce it, but yes.
Okay. That case that they made a determination that if the law said that an individual is given the opportunity to, if it was phrased in that way, because they're weird, then that right exists there. And in this instance, it is phrased that way. Like you say, they just decided we're not going to do it. But doesn't this open up the Pandora's box and say that it is really also chipping? Because I guess theoretically, you know, Planned Parenthood, I mean, although I don't know if they have the money to do this, but theoretically could like split off. Planned Parenthood is one LLC or a corporation, and then Women's Health, you know, is another, you know, that type of thing. But this seems to undermine, like chip away at the ability of an individual to say, hey, you're not following federal law. And if you're not following federal law, I'm going to sue the state for inhibiting what the feds intended me to do. And it seems to basically eliminate that right or cut it away seriously.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So the law that we're really talking about here is the 1871 Civil Rights Act, the first Civil Rights Act. You know, most people know about the 1964 one, but the 1871 one was the most important at the time. It is the one that we ratified the 14th Amendment in order so we could pass that law, right? The argument at the time was that you needed the 14th Amendment because without the 14th Amendment, the 1871 Civil Rights Act wouldn't be constitutional, right? So that's kind of the backstory of the amendment. And there's a section in that Civil Rights Act called Section 1983 that allows for a private right to sue when the government violates your civil rights, right? And I've explained before that if you do not have a right to sue the government when it does something to you, then the law preventing the government from doing that thing to you is not a law. It's just a suggestion. It's just a hope, right? It's only through the ability to sue the government to enforce your rights that your rights become rights, that your rights become things that you can defend. Otherwise, the government can violate them willy-nilly. And what the court said in the Planned Parenthood case was that Section 1983 of the 1871 Civil Rights Act, this provision that allows for the private right to sue, doesn't support the private right to sue unless Congress has been exceedingly clear that a civil right exists, right? And again, if you look at the Medicaid Act, I don't know how Congress could be more clear that you have a civil right for freedom of choice of healthcare provider. But Neil Gorsuch says, oh, that's not clear enough. And so it takes away this ability, this, again, at this point, ancient ability that we have to sue the government for our civil rights. Sam, you're the first host to brought up Talevsky, which is super legal weedy. But another thing that's going on in this case is that Talevsky, the case that you mentioned, that was 2 years ago.
Yes, 2023.
This court was like, actually, no, you have a private right to sue as long as Congress says you have a private right to sue, right? And then 2 years later, they're like, remember that president? Screw it. We're done with it. And so it's one of these like legal weedy situations where like, just beyond the culture war issue about abortion and Planned Parenthood, beyond the legal issue of whether or not you have a private right to sue the government for violation of civil rights, there's also just at its core this clown show of a Supreme Court that can't even hold true to its precedents over a couple of years, right? Because they literally settled this 2 years ago in Talvesky, and now all of a sudden, oh, actually, Talvesky doesn't make sense. So now, whether or not Congress creates the private right to sue depends on how closely they followed the Supreme Court's words in this one case, as opposed to what Congress was actually trying to do. It is a bonkers decision in terms of just its legal grounding, for sure, before you even get to the larger social and cultural issues around the Civil Rights Act and abortion rights.
Let's move on to the so-called birthright citizenship case, which isn't, again, directly about it's not going to implicate birthright citizenship, I think, as much as people maybe anticipate. It might. But I also got to say, just, you know, as a note, like, you know, we talk about that section 1983, the assault on all of the laws from Reconstruction. Like, I have always considered Reconstruction to be sort of like the actual founding of this country as we live it today, in the same way that, like, rabbinic Judaism is the Judaism that we practice today, as opposed to, like, when we had high priests and we were doing, taking a lamb and sacrificing it on the altar. We're living in a Reconstruction world, but this court really, really is trying to sort of bring us back to just like 1864.
I argued, Sam, that people who frame this court as an attack on the 20th century, an attack on the civil rights era, an attack on the Warren Court, that's old news. The Supreme Court has won its battle against the 20th century. It has won its battle against the Warren Court. And talking about that is talking about the last war. The Supreme Court has moved on, not to fighting the 20th century, but to fighting the 19th century. To fighting the Reconstruction era, to fighting what Eric Foner calls the second founding of this country. They don't like that either. They don't like the Reconstruction era either, and they have moved on to directly attacking the laws and amendments and statutes and precedents that came out of that second founding, came out of the Reconstruction era. And once again, they're winning. They're winning their second Civil War without firing a shot. So we are now literally relitigating things, not that we fought about in the 1960s, but that we fought a hot war about in the 1860s, and we're losing. We're losing to this new Confederacy.
And it feels like they're not even arguing their way through it. They're just going, it's like they're just flicking a switch, essentially, and saying, we're just going to pluck, we're just hitting these switches and that's it. We're not going to have to argue or create some type of like,
we're just going to turn that off.
It would be fascinating if it wasn't so disturbing and having real world implications. This birthright citizenship case, it's unclear to me. It's unclear to me, like, does birthright citizenship still exist? Will it exist? Are there people now who are stateless or could be stateless? And then there's this, the main order question is, can a single judge issue an order to stay a law? And that to me seems unclear. Like, the whole thing seems still unclear where we're at.
Yeah, so you're asking a lot of questions that are difficult to answer because the Supreme Court's opinion itself was gobbledygook, right? Like you're kind of forced to guess at what they could mean because their legal reasoning was so loose and clownish again. I'll try to answer the question this way. At the top level, if you are a child born in this country after June 27th, 2025, right? So if you were born on Friday or Saturday or Sunday or today, whether or not you're a citizen of this country now depends more on the state or county you were born in than whether or not you were born in America, right? Because what's going to happen is that some states, most states even, will uphold the concept of birthright citizenship, but some states will not, right? We'll have some localities, I can think of Texas as one, that probably won't, right? And so now, as you take that child who's born yesterday, literally born yesterday, and you fast forward 15, 18, 20 years, their birth certificate might not be enough to prove their citizenship, because they might not have gotten a valid birth certificate at birth, because this random local official in Texas on Sunday might have denied them a birth certificate because the Supreme Court said they could. And the way that they said they could goes to this nationwide injunction argument, right? So like for your listeners to understand, like an injunction is just saying that the government wants to do a thing and we decide as the court, the government cannot do that, right? We preemptively decide the government's idea, law, program, whatever, program, whatever is illegal, right? So if they had a law saying, hey, we're going to take all the Jewish journalists and kick them out of the country, right? You, Sam, might go to court and say, hey, that seems horribly unconstitutional to me. I would like a ruling stopping the government from kicking me out of the country just because I'm a Jewish journalist, right? And a court might agree with you. A court might say, yeah, Sam, you're absolutely right. They cannot kick you out of the country. Now, before Friday, that ruling could apply nationwide. They can't kick any Jewish journalist out of the country just for being a Jewish journalist. But after Friday, according to the Supreme Court, that ruling can probably only apply to you, Sam. So you, Sam, went to court and you, Sam, got a ruling saying that you, Sam, as a Jewish journalist, cannot be kicked out of the country. And that's great for Sam. But what about the next guy? What about the next guy? What about the guy living in Texas? What about the guy living in Michigan? They have to sue themselves. They have to personally go to court to sue. Again, this obviously unconstitutional rule. They have to personally go to court and sue for themselves again and again and again and again and again. And even if 99% of them win, 1% of them will lose. And then we will have a two-tiered system where some Jewish journalists are going to be kicked out, but other Jewish journalists are not. And that's how it's going to be, according to the Supreme Court, until sometime in the future, perhaps soon, perhaps by next year, perhaps not soon, perhaps in 3 or 4 years, the Supreme Court will come back in and weigh in nationwide on whether or not Trump's unconstitutional laws are in fact unconstitutional, right? But in the meantime, there's going to be a lot of chaos and confusion and uncertainty because the courts took away this fundamental ability of courts to enforce the law against the president.
And isn't the sort of the paradox here, and I can't remember if it was KBJ or or Kagan who brought this up, is that let's assume that, to use your analogy, you know, you have Jewish journalists after Jewish journalists, they go, they win their cases. The government does not appeal them because they're like, look, there's
clearly wrong.
10,000 Jewish journalists in the country, or 5,000 Jewish journalists country. We know they're not all going to come to court. There's maybe like 500 will come to court. We just won't appeal that. It will not rise to the Supreme Court. I mean, it would involve essentially somebody losing that case and then appealing so that it would rise up. And it's quite possible that if it went up to the first appellate level, the government just says, we're not going to contest. And that way it never rises up to the Supreme Court. And we don't have a law of the land anymore for something that's in the Constitution.
For citizenship. And to go back to what we were talking about in terms of the attack on the Reconstruction era and the attack on the 19th century, we have tried to do citizenship this way before. We have tried to live in a country where whether or not you were a citizen of that country depended on the state you were living in, right? We called that the antebellum period of America. That was the slavery period of America. That was the period where, as a black person, if I was born in Georgia, you know, I had one set of rights. And if I was born in New York, I had a different one, right? Just depending on the happenstance of my birth. That way led to war. That way was so unworkable that it led to a shooting war, because you cannot have a country where some citizens are more equal than other citizens, all right? We're not living on the animal farm. But the Supreme Court brings us right back to that situation of potential two-tiered citizenship in this case. The other thing that I've heard a lot from liberals, you were talking about how the government might get around this by just not appealing adverse rulings against it. The other thing I've heard from a lot of liberals is this idea of a class action, right? That because the Supreme Court has made everybody sue individually, what needs to happen is that everybody needs to come together as a class of affected people and sue as a class action lawsuit. You see this all the time in environmental litigation. You saw it all the time in big tobacco litigation, trying to form a large class of people to tell the government that they're wrong on birthright citizenship. That's a great idea. That's a fine legal idea that this decision leaves open as a possibility, except that you have to remember that the exact same six people who just said the government could get away with this messing with a birthright citizenship can just as easily refuse to recognize and what's called certify a class action. And the Roberts Court has been notorious historically in denying certification of classes for various suits, right? For various things that are like much lower stakes than what we're talking about here. And the Roberts Court consistently denies class status to citizens. So there's every opportunity that we'll be here next year talking about a Supreme Court decision that decertifies a class 6-3, and we'll be trying to explain once again how that allows Trump to mess with birthright citizenship, right? Because the Supreme Court, if they've done it here, they can keep doing it. They can keep denying people their rights to sue the government. And just as the last point on that, Clarence Thomas basically says so in his concurrence to this opinion. Basically, don't you try the class actions. Don't you try it, because if you do, we're going to knock it down. He says that in his concurrence. Does he have 5 votes for that? I don't know, but I wouldn't assume that he doesn't.
And lastly, is there a scenario where, okay, I'm born in New York, but I go to Tennessee. They don't recognize, birthright citizenship. Can they just, in the same way that, like, in the early days of marriage equality, if I got into a same-sex marriage in Massachusetts, but I go to, Georgia and want visitation rights because my partner's in the hospital, you're not married to him. Well, I am, but you're married in Massachusetts. We don't recognize that. I mean, is there a potential scenario like where it's just like, we're going to deport, we deport you if you're in, if you travel to Georgia, even though you may be safe in New York.
Sam, that's the most likely scenario. That's the most likely thing to happen. That when you have, and again,
it's like a fugitive slave law type of situation.
I'm about to say, we've yep. tried it this way before. It was called the Dred Scott decision, right? What was the whole point? What was the whole issue behind the Dred Scott decision, right? That my man went to Missouri. Missouri was a free state. And he was like, I'm free. And then they were like, no, you got to go back to Kentucky. And he was like, well, no, I'm free in Missouri. And the whole point of the Dred Scott decision was that actually a black man has no rights. The white man is bound to respect, right? It was this person, Dred Scott, who did have citizenship rights where he was, could be recaptured and re-pulled back in to a situation where he had no rights simply by traveling across state lines. That there was no such thing as forever free. That's exact. So when I'm saying it's the most likely scenario, the scenario that you outlined is the most likely scenario. It is the one based on precedent in history. It is what this country has done before. So absolutely there's a situation. There's a possibility. There's a likely possibility that a person will have a certain suite of rights and protections if they stay in New York or New Jersey. But if they go to Pennsylvania, it becomes more questionable. And if they go all the way to West Virginia, they're done.
All right, let's just. I want to briefly talk about what amounts to me, from my perspective, is a ban in elementary schools virtually across the country on having any gay or bi or lesbian or trans or queer characters in books in elementary schools. I mean, that's not exactly the ruling, but that's the sort of like, that's the de facto ruling, right? I mean, that's sort of like the Brandeisian analysis of this is what it's going to lead to. And it's nuts.
On any other week, on any other day, this bigoted ruling would be the thing that everybody was talking about. Alito's opinion in this case is called Mahmoud versus Taylor, and it involves a group of families, Muslim, Catholic, and Ukrainian Orthodox, I believe, families who sued the school because the school used a number of children's storybooks that depicted LGBTQ people existing. That's all they were doing. It was just they were in the story, right? It wasn't about being LGBTQ. It wasn't like, hey, let's all be gay and have sex in the plot. No, it was just here's some gay people anyway onto the story. And these parents, these bigoted parents, like flipped a bit. And these are public school parents, remember? That becomes important.
Yep.
And they sue to force the public school to inform them anytime these books or texts were going to be used and to allow their children to opt out of any education involving those books. Well, if you've ever been in a public school or run a public school, you know that it's practically unworkable to have to clear your entire day's curriculum on a daily basis with a bunch of parents. This is in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is one of the largest public, it's a suburb of DC. It's one of the largest public school districts in the country. And so the ruling saying that parents can opt out of these books essentially means that these books cannot be practically used in class. And that's the top line ruling. But like I cannot emphasize enough. I literally don't have the words to fully explain how bigoted and homophobic Sam Alito's opinion was in this case. One of the books that he really has a problem, like, he spends most of the thing, he's not talking about the law. He's fighting cultural war issues. He's worried about pronouns. I mean, it's like if an AI chatbot told you write a Supreme Court opinion in the method of the last 20 minutes of Fox News, that would be about what Sam Alito sounded like an AI chatbot version of himself. But the level of bigotry is shocking. So one of the stories that he focuses on is this story called Uncle Bobby's Wedding, right? And it's just, all it is Uncle Bobby is having a same-sex marriage, and the main character, Chloe, his niece, is very worried about them having the same-sex marriage because she thinks that when Uncle Bobby gets married, that'll mean less playtime for her. That is the plot line of like 11 billion children's stories, right? It's the plot line every time the children's story about, oh, you got a new sibling. Oh, wait, what's that going to mean for me? That's the plot line, right? It's the plot line of the Toy Story franchise, for God's sakes. It is a simple children's plot line, but Alito suggests actually no. Chloe doesn't like the gay marriage, but everybody else does. And they're forcing Chloe to accept, universally approve of this gayness. Like, that is how Alito writes his opinion. And then he puts pictures of Uncle Bobby's wedding into his opinion as if, like, showing the pictures. And yes, one of the pictures is Uncle Bobby with his husband. It's like, that's going to be proof. Look at the subversive, horrible, gay nature of this book. We have to ban it.
Vergonia.
It is off the chain bigoted. It is off the chain homophobic. And as you say, Sam, the result is in public schools, you're not going to be allowed to use these texts. And there's a particular line that I focus on in the piece that I'm writing where he says that it's not enough to tell these people, like we should tell these people, hey, if you want to instruct your kids in a world that doesn't include gay people, homeschool them, you idiot. That's what homeschool is there for. So you can control everything that goes in. Keep your child in the attic like it was done in ancient times and leave the rest of us to our society. But Alita says, no, we can't tell them that because it's too expensive. It's too expensive to homeschool children. And so we have to allow public schools to provide kind of all of the protections for religious cuckoo for Cocoa Puffs people that a private school would provide or a homeschool would provide. Again, it's an insane ruling, and it's one that you can't even justify legally. It only makes sense if you also agree with Alito's homophobic and bigoted premises. If you're not afraid of gay people, the entire ruling falls apart in terms of any kind of logic.
This may not come as a shock to our audience, but I will be explicit about this. I don't like Christmas. I'm not a big Christmas fan. I don't like Christmas trees. I actually like...
They got Chinese food haver on.
What are my rights? I mean, it's not exactly a religious thing, although I would imagine, absence my Judaism, the idea of, but I certainly could make the case that it's a function of my being Jewish. I know Jews who do like Christmas, but I consider them fallen. What is the limiting principle here for what we can? Well, they can decide that a religious can decide that they need this much, so much accommodation. Their religion requires so much accommodation that, in fact, we basically have to ban the existence of gay people in elementary schools.
Under Alito's opinion, you as a Jewish person could absolutely sue the school to prevent them from having any book that mentions Christmas, discusses Christmas, or even shows a tree with baubles on it. That would be enough for you to get the book banned, according to Alito's decision.
As to the way I felt when I had to, like, O. Tannenbaum, the right. Pressure that, on me.
That would be enough under Alito's position. A Muslim family who wants to sue because the book depicts a woman with uncovered hair, that would be enough. A Catholic family who's like, oh, that woman is unmarried and owns property. Get that book out of the school.
I was going to say.
There is no limiting principle in Alito's opinion, which means that the actual limiting principle is Alito's own Catholic bigotry and theocracy, right? Because, of course, Sam, if you do bring that suit, do you think you're going to win in front of Sam Alito? Do you think Sam Alito is going to be like, well, as we said in Mahmood v. Taylor, now we have to get Christmas trees out of the school? Do you think I'm going to win if I show up to court and be like, slavery and white supremacy is against my religion, so I think any mention of the original U.S. Constitution has to be banned in schools, or at least my kids have to be opt out of any teachings about the U.S. Constitution? Do you think I'm going to win that in front of Sam? Do you think I'm going to win that in front of Amy Handmaid Coney Barrett? No. So the actual limiting principle, since there is no legal limiting principle in their decision, the actual limiting principle is whatever these six bigoted you-know-whats think. That's the limit. So if they are not personally offended by Christmas trees, guess what? Christmas trees books still on the table. But if they are personally offended by, like, anytime you have more than seven candles, then that book with a menorah, that can get banned.
It's nuts. It's nuts. All right. Lastly, I got to ask you about this because Leonard Leo, the former head of the Federalist Society, really the one who, I shouldn't know if he was the actual head, but the one who really took it into, created it into what it is today, the one who created sort of the networking, the fundraising. He's the one who, when Clarence Thomas 20 years ago was complaining about being broke and that he might have to retire from the Supreme Court because he doesn't have any money, he introduced him to Harlan Crow. And then what do you know? These guys just hit it off. And one of the benefits of being best friends with a billionaire is that he pays for your kid to go to private school. He pays for your mom's house. He takes you on private jets and takes you on vacations. It's a shame Leonard Leo doesn't pair us all up with billionaires. It would be very fun. But He also basically chose all the justices for the Trump administration first time around. And after Trump's trade laws were the tariff court basically said these things are bunk. Trump had a fit, got into a fight with Leonard Leo. We should just remind you, Leonard Leo was donated $1 billion a couple of years ago to start a new organization. We don't know what he's doing with that money, or I'm not aware of it. And what does this mean that they're having a fight? Is it going to mean something materially in terms of like what we see courts do or the capacity of the Trump administration to appoint new judges?
So I think that the fight between Trump and Leo is more important politically and legally for our country than the kind of real tech bros of L.A. fight between Trump and Musk. Right. I'm sorry that, you know, the Trump and Musk romance is over, but the Trump Leo connection has far more impact on our polity, because, as you say, Leo invented and created the judicial making machine that is the federal society. And he is responsible. All these bad decisions that we've been talking about today, Leonard Leo is one of the two guys most responsible for them, the other one being Mitch McConnell, of course. So if these two guys split, if Trump and the Republican political agenda split from Leo and the Republican legal agenda, it is potentially a huge rift. Now, the reason why the rift happens is because Republican judges nominated or created essentially by Leo, by Leo, and Republican politicians, now all under the thumb of Donald Trump, do not always agree. They aren't always working in the same way. They agree generally that like gay people are bad and women shouldn't have rights and black people should be shot. Like, they agree about the big ticket issues, but kind of operationally, there are real differences there. What Trump wants are judges that are completely loyal to him and will do whatever he wants. What Leo wants are judges that are completely loyal to the Feller Society and have, you know, and are always playing the long game about, like I said, relitigating now the 19th century. If they are split up, one of the things that's going to happen is that it's going to take Trump longer to find, appoint, and confirm judges, right? Because Leo, that all that's on speed dial with him, right? All of that is standardized with him. You want a judge in North Dakota? I can get you a judge in North Dakota. Don't ask me how. I can get you a judge in North Dakota. Like, he's got a whole system in place. Now, if Trump wants a judge in North Dakota, how's he going to find one? Right? How is he going to find one that's loyal to him, that's going to be, and then going to find one that's going to be loyal enough to him, but also be able to pass the Senate confirmation process that is, yes, controlled by Republicans, but controlled by Republicans who have gotten very used to just approving whoever Leo says they should approve? What's going to happen if there is conflict? It could slow Trump down. Now, the kinds of judges that Trump will appoint that are loyal to him will be worse than the judges that Leo would appoint. Like, I shudder when I say that out loud, because it's hard for me to think of anything worse than FedSoc judges, but there is something worse, and that's Trump judges, right? Those are judges that are completely loyal to Trump. They will be worse on these big ticket issues about Trump's personal powers and his personal ability to thwart democracy in the short term. But in the long term, the thing that Leo has done so well is that because he makes these judges basically in a lab, right? Because they're, you know, Neil Gorsuch is a test tube amalgamation made by Leonard Leo. So he knows everything that Neil Gorsuch is going to do for the rest of Neil Gorsuch's life, right? He's read ahead in Neil Gorsuch's own obituary, and he knows everything that's going to happen next, right? He doesn't know everything that's going to happen with Eileen Cannon. Right? He doesn't know how she's going to evolve and develop and whatever. And so while short-term, Justice Eileen Cannon, terrible on all these Trump issues, I don't know that Justice Eileen Cannon is worse than your, you know, replacement-level Leonard Leo judge when it comes to 10, 15, 20 years out. I don't know. And I do know that it takes you a lot longer to confirm Eileen Cannon because she's unqualified, because she's just a Trump sycophant, because she doesn't have the Federal Society backing. It takes you a lot longer to confirm her than it does to any one of 20 people that are sitting in Leonard Leo's pocket right now. So long term, this is potentially a huge legal rift within the conservatives themselves, proving, as you know, the old adage, the revolution always eats its young.
So I mean, it sounds like there's two elements to this. One is that you're cutting down on the network effect that exists with all the Federalist judges, where I'm going to go clerk for this judge, and that's the way that I move up within the context of the Federalist Society, and then I have the proper pedigree. Emil Bovee may just, you know, his clerk may be just the dude that, you know, was his caddy at or whatever. Who knows who it is? And then it also forestalls the ability of the Federalist Society to move law in a specific direction, because there's two elements to it, if I understand what you're saying. You know, there's the judge, and then, you know, there's the pitcher and the catcher in that sense. And it's like, they need to know what cases they should be looking for 1 year out, 2 years out, 5 years out, to essentially unwind, 100 years of case law, so that they can step by step sort of move this along. But if you don't know their legal sort of like pedigree and thinking, it's harder to predict what's going to change the law in the way you want it to.
I love the pitcher and catcher analogy. I haven't used it before, but I'm just going to steal it now forever. Because that is exactly right, right? There's a reason why the catcher calls the pitches, right? The catcher needs to know, is it going to be a fastball or is it going to be a curveball? If the catcher doesn't know and it's a curveball, guess what? It's a wild pitch. Catcher can't react in real time to that. They have to know before the pitch is thrown. That's exactly what it's like with Federalist Society judges and test cases organized by the Federalist Society, right? They have to know what pitch is coming so they can shape the law in the way that they want. And if you don't know, if you're not on the same page, that leaves open the opportunity for more wild pitches. Now, again, some of them are going to be wild pitches. Some of them are just like the liberal batter is going to get beamed in the head with a fastball. Right? Like, it's not going to be pretty all of the times. But you're adding – here's what I'm trying to say. You're adding more uncertainty into the situation, right? And when you are in a fascist state, when you are in a theocratic state, when you have a court that has and a Republican Party that has everything on lockdown, uncertainty is your friend. Uncertainty is actually a boon, because not knowing, if they don't know what they're going to do next, that creates then opportunities for resistance, for fighting, you see Emil Bov, he'll probably get confirmed, but it's a much rougher ride than it would have been for any Federal Society judge, again, of the 20 that are sitting in Leonard Leo's pocket right now. So that uncertainty creates more opportunities for resistance and fight back.
And to be fair, I mean, Bov, as one of the top law enforcement officials in the country and the DOJ, was going to completely ignore a judge. And then they completely tried to cover that all up. So it's pretty extreme, but he's probably going to get passed through.
I also just want to really quickly argue that, like, it is possible that with the kind of disgustingness that Trump is going to put on the court without Leo trying to shape it and smooth it down, maybe Democrats wake up. Maybe Democrats are like, hey, if they're having people like Emil Bov on the court, maybe we got to take the court seriously. Maybe, I don't know, when we get in charge, we got to expand the courts to deal with people like, I don't know. I mean, it's always possible, right?
I
live in the world where it's always possible that one day the Democrats will try on the courts.
Oh, Ellie.
It can happen, man.
That was very sweet. I am so glad that you ended that on an optimistic note. That was all right.
Democrats.
I'll tell you something. That you could be that optimistic by the end of the interview, I feel like I've taken you to another place.
I've got to have some hope, man, or else it just, it's.
I understand.
You got to find some way to keep getting up in the morning.
Ali Mistal, we'll, of course, link to all your pieces at The Nation and your book, Bad Law. Always a real pleasure to talk to you. And thanks again for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me.
All right, folks. We're going to head into the fun half. If Ellie's going to use a baseball metaphor, he's got to understand baseball. I think he does. Oh boy, this is, somebody broke the chat by putting in a massive link. We got to somehow fix that, because I got like a screen.
Because somebody could break it every single day and just massively interrupt our comms.
Yeah. Folks, just not our comms, but that, whatever.
Comms with the members.
Comms with the members. Folks, it's your support that makes this show possible. You can join the Majority Report by going to jointhemajorityreport.com. When you do, you not only get the free show free of commercials, but you get the fun half. And you get to I am in the fun half. And sometimes, you can break the chat by putting in a, you know, massive fake link or whatever it is. Probably shouldn't have said that.
Probably not.
Also, Just Coffee. JustCoffee.coop. Fair trade coffee, hot chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. Also, when you use that coupon code MAJORITY, 10% off at Just Coffee, it breaks the chat. I probably shouldn't have said that.
Don't become a member just to break our chat, folks.
Yes. Matt, what's happening on Left Reckoning?
Left Reckoning, we had a Sunday show for patrons, patreon.com/LeftReckoning, talk about Zoran's win and Peter Thiel's little Antichrist freak out with Russ Douth. That also, I was on with the Vanguard, also talking about Zoran, so check that out. You can see my fresh sunburn from the Rockaways.
That's not a sunburn, that's a wind rash.
Yeah, I mean, you should see my back. I could feel myself not getting certain parts of
my back.
Did you not
put any sunblock on?
I did. I could feel myself missing certain parts of my back, and I just thought, that'll probably be okay. And turns out it was not really okay. So, yeah.
All right, quick break. Head into the fun half. 646-257-3920. We'll take some calls after a bit. 3 months from now, 6 months from now, 9 months from now, and I don't think it's going to be the same as it looks like in 6 months from now, and I don't know if it's necessarily going to be better 6 months from now than it is 3 months from now, but I think around 18 months out, we're going to look back and go like, wow.
What? What is that going on?
It's nuts.
Wait a second. Hold on for a second. The Majority
Report. Emma, welcome to the program.
Hey.
Matt.
Who? What is up, everyone? Nomi Key.
You did it. Let's go, Brandon.
Bradley, you want to say hello?
Sorry to disappoint everyone. I'm just a random guy.
It's all the boys today.
Fundamentally false.
No, I'm sorry. Women.
Stop talking for a second. Now let me finish.
Where is this coming from, dude?
But dude, you want to smoke this 7A?
Yes.
Hi, me? Is it?
Yes.
Is this me?
Is it me?
It is you.
Is this me? Hello, is this me?
I think it is you. Who is you? No sound. Every single freaking day. What's on your mind?
Sports. We can discuss free markets and we can discuss capitalism.
I'm gonna go tell what.
Who libertarians?
They're so stupid though.
Common sense says, of course.
Gobbledygook.
We fucking nailed it! them.
So what's 79 plus 21?
Challenge met.
I'm positively quivering.
I believe 96, I want to say. 857-210-35-501. One half. 3/8.
9/11, for instance.
$3,400. $1,900.
$6,543 trillion sold. It's a zero-sum game.
Actually, you're making me think less of
it. But let me say this. Poop.
Call it satire. Sam goes satire.
On top of it all,
yeah.
My favorite part about you is just like every day, all day, like everything you do.
Without a doubt. Hey, buddy, we see you. All right, folks.
It's just the week being weeded out, obviously.
Yeah, Sundial Guns out. I don't know.
But you should know.
People just don't like to entertain ideas anymore.
I have a question. Who cares?
Our chat is enabled,
wow,
folks.
I love it.
I do love that.
Look, gotta jump. Gotta be quick. I gotta jump.
I'm losing it, bro.
2 o'clock. We're already late. And the guy's being a dick. So screw him. Sent to a gulag?
Outrageous.
Like, what is wrong with you?
Love you, bye.
Love you. Bye-bye. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report. Fun half. Emma Vigeland out for a honeymoon. You know who really wants to travel on a honeymoon, but he's already married. And can you imagine? I just want you to think about this scenario. We live in a country right now where we have immigrants terrorized, literally terrorized. We have families of immigrants who are not immigrants themselves terrorized. We have 500,000 Haitians in the country who've been here on temporary protected status, going to have to go back to Haiti, which is, again, a tremendous mess. But they're being told they need to get out of the country within 2 or 3 months. We have LGBTQ bans in elementary schools. We have trans kids who are banned essentially from getting health care. Soon, perhaps, adults unable to get gender-affirming care. We have one of the worst pieces of legislation that have been passed or about to be passed in my lifetime. And I'm old. I remember the Telecommunications Act of 1996. I remember the so-called welfare reform of the mid-90s. The police, the crime bill. Horrible pieces of legislation. Really bad. And yet, John Fetterman is fuming about having to stick around and missing an outing on the weekend.
Did you get any clues on the floor about what time this might wrap?
Oh my God! I just want to go home. I've missed our entire trip to the beach. My family's going to be back before we. So, I, and again, I'm going to vote no. There's no drama. You know, the votes are going to go. In fact, the only interesting votes are going to be on the margin, whether that's Collins or Johnson and those. But all the Democrats, we all know how that's going to go. And I don't think it's really helpful to put people here till when some ungodly hour. And again,
thank you, sir.
Thank you.
He's complaining because last night, two nights ago, the Democrats made the Senate reporter or a secretary, I'm not exactly sure what they call it, read the bill. And then there's an extended votorama of voting for amendments that started this morning. And the reason why you do this is because it's extraordinary. And it keeps reporters on the beat. They've got to stay in the Senate. They've got to report on it. If you look at all of the political reporting today, it's all been about that. And the reason why you do it is because you're trying to communicate to people, this bill is about to pass. It is a horrible, horrible bill. We played the Harry Enten polling up front. This bill polls somewhere between -19% and -29%. It is a horrible bill, and people don't even begin to understand the implications of it. And so you pull stunts like this, even if the outcome is predetermined, which it seemingly is, but not necessarily. He even said there's some votes on the margin, like, you know, Collins on one side, Johnson on the other. And the idea that he has like the audacity to complain about this. He is one of 100 people in the country who get to decide on this. 100 people will decide for 330 plus million people. And he's bitching about it. I have an idea. Go home. Stay there. Resign. Bye-bye.
Well, they didn't poll, to be fair. They pulled the big, beautiful bill. They didn't poll, you know, how much Americans want Fetterman to get his beach days in.
It is difficult for the country to look at that head being so pale. We need more tanning happening on that guy. And
it sounds like it needs a nice long vacation.
I mean, maybe it's time he thinks about retirement. It's just unbelievable. What an ass. What a total ass. Here is State Senator Mallory McMurrow. She's in the Michigan State Capitol. She's running for, Senate in Michigan as well. She's talking about this disaster of a bill that the Senate is en route to passing. And it is a massive transfer of wealth to the wealthy. Government, and here's the bottom line, government always redistributes money. Always, always. Every government that has ever existed, in fact, probably every society that has ever existed, redistributes wealth in one form or another. That is like literally the function. It is impossible to have a society where there is not a redistribution of wealth. It's almost definitional to the name. May not be, you know, currency that is redistributed, but it's just impossible. So the question always is, in which way is it flowing? Which way does it flow? And this bill is a massive redistribution of money to the top. Play this clip.
Today, we are on the verge of the single largest redistribution of wealth from poor and working class Michiganders to the rich in our nation's history. That's what we're staring down in this so-called big, beautiful bill. And sure, if you're already wealthy, this bill is going to be great for you. If you earn more than $715,800, congratulations, you will get a tax cut of over $50,000. That tax cut alone is significantly higher than the $39,500 that the average Michigander earns in an entire year. Are you a foreign investor? Congratulations. Collectively, you will all get $23 billion in tax cuts next year alone. Are you in a position to leave more than $7 million to your heirs? Congratulations. You will get a cut to the estate tax. But how does this bill pay for all of this? By cutting the services that you rely on. This big bad bill cuts more than $200 billion from food assistance, potentially affecting 4 million children and 7 million adults nationwide. In Michigan, SNAP provides vital food assistance to over 1.4 million Michiganders. That's approximately 15% of our state's population. SNAP dollars fuel $2 billion in economic activity supporting farms and grocery stores, especially in our rural communities. But colleagues, proponents of this bill, and I have heard it here today, will argue that it's just about cutting so-called waste, fraud, and abuse, and that these cuts are necessary, and that enacting these cuts will benefit everybody. That argument is a flat-out lie. The University of Michigan economist Justin Wolfers analyzed the impact of all of the Trump policies combined. The cuts to Medicare, Medicaid, and SNAP found in this big bad bill, the tax cuts here that overwhelmingly benefit the rich, and Trump's reckless tariff policy that adds cost to the food and the goods that so many of us rely on in our daily lives, with that additional cost not borne by the country of origin, not borne by the importer, not borne by the retailer, but passed on to you. Combined over the next 10 years, here's how those policies will impact you. If you are in the lowest 10% of earners making just under $19,000 a year, you will lose $2,600. If you're in the lowest 25% of earners making $40,000 a year, you will lose $1,600. If you're the median income earner, if you make $80,000 a year, you will lose $1,200. If you're in the top 75% of earners making $1,470, you will lose $600. If you're in the top 80% of earners, you will lose $500. Are you picking up on a trend here? But if you happen to be in the top 10% of earners earning over $250,000 a year, congratulations, you will gain an average of $7,200. 90% of Americans will lose money over the next 10 years to give the wealthiest 10% of Americans more money. That's insane. 50 years of trickle-down economics has shown us clearly that it simply does not work. The wealthiest Americans are wealthier than they ever have been before, while just about everyone else, from low income to middle class, is struggling to make ends meet. Right. But do not fret.
And for those who still out there laughably cite the Laffer curve, and the idea that somehow we're going to get more revenue because we've cut taxes, because it's going to spur such a huge GDP growth. Go back to 2017. Go back to look at the promises of 4% growth that never, ever, ever materialized with those tax cuts. Never, ever. Let's go to the IMs. R.M. Brown shared a video last Friday of Tim Pool name-dropping and attempting to mock you, Sam. Might be fun to take a look if we want to have a laugh. I think we're going to do that tomorrow.
Yeah, check out tomorrow.
Matt, I have not seen it yet, but Matt mentioned it.
It's good stuff.
He's so good at that.
He's very upset, and he...
Is he very upset? Did we change the audio...
That's why we have to do it tomorrow, is I got to run it through my audio filters.
Okay. Get the call down to Audio Tech. Tell those guys they're going to work all night Because we're going to need this stuff by tomorrow morning when we start the show. Tell them that nobody goes home tonight until that audio stuff is done.
But I wanted to go to the beach.
I don't care about the beach. We need to get this done. I want it completely audio processed. Niles, I was laid off this morning. The company has already been drastically impacted by the moratorium on wind farm development, which led directly to the reduction in staff by hundreds. The cascade effect has now come to fall on very talented people who have been with the company long enough to make a good wage, but not long enough to be management. I'm looking at this as a gift, but face the hard realization that I may be a couple steps from financial edge. Thank you all. You do. Left is best. So sorry to hear that. There's going to be a lot of people in your boat. I want to make it clear, if you are a member and you start to suspect that you have reason to be concerned about, you know, financial stress going down the road, send us an email majorityreporters@gmail.com. Put in the subject line member problem, and we will work it out with you. Don't want anybody going through any financial stress to be worried about paying for the show. So just send us an email and listen, do yourself a favor and anticipate it. Don't hold out a couple of months. Charlie Jerk, can't Democrats do that thing where they have 30 senators challenge an executive order and halt business with a mandatory debate? Apparently, the reversing the CRA stuff is difficult. The Republicans have an ability to thwart that. So they're not going to be able to tie that up. I know what you're referring to. We had talked about it on the show, I think, a couple of weeks ago. My understanding is that the Republicans do have a parliamentary way of, even though the CRA reversals would be privileged, they do have it a way of preventing it from hitting the floor. Ramona Frankenstein, Sam, I hope you kept abreast of the most important cultural event of all the Bay State this weekend, which I mean the greasy pole walk in Gloucester. A couple of dozen drunkest Italian-Americans in the state slipped and fell into the drink until a young guy named Nick White grabbed the flag off the end of the pole. Afterward, he was hoisted on the shoulders of several men, carried around the streets of Gloucester to all the bars where he drank for free. Well done, Mr. White. I actually spent a summer in Gloucester, like 40 years ago. I never heard about that. Dust Collectors had a nightmare that the Majority Report stopped broadcasting and instead became a segment on MSNBC that shared no host or format or similarity to the actual show. It was just random people yapping. All y'all were gone, instead replaced by everything bagel version of The Five on Fox.
What was the buyout like?
It must have been big. Must have been really big. Catlek, I tuned into the Vanguard yesterday when Matt was on. Silly and Billy are doing a great job. That said, I never heard the word shout out repeated as many times as I did during the last 30 to 45 minutes of this show. I think maybe it was like a Guinness World Record attempt.
Shout out the Vanguard.
Let's play number 10. As each day goes by, it feels like we're seeing two things. That some of the key players, the unions and the people of New York, are beginning to rally more and more around Zohran Mamdani. And we're not seeing you know, Andrew Cuomo arise. It sounds like he's going to stay on the ballot, but it doesn't sound like he's going to do anything else, which I would imagine is going to inhibit Eric Adams. But that's my sense of it. There are still some out there who have yet to apologize for the incredible Islamophobia. I'm thinking of Senator Christian Gillibrand. I'm also thinking of, like, congressmen who have not congratulated the Democratic nominee. That's insane to me. Goldman. Here's Brad Lander speaking at Israelis for Peace rally in Union Square yesterday.
Upper West Side and attacked me and Zoran and Adrian and thought that weaponizing Jewish fear, thought that weaponizing anti-Semitism would be the way for him to win this race. And of course, for much of the race, it looked like it would be enough. And the fact that at the end of the day, a hopeful politics, a Muslim New Yorker and a Jewish New Yorker campaigning together and saying, we don't have to have politics being a kind of zero sum, us versus them, dark, sour, selfish thing, but instead could try to come together across some lines of difference, inspired mostly by an idea in this city that everyone needs a home they could afford in a neighborhood they love and feel safe in with a great school for their kids. But it sure doesn't hurt to imagine that it could also be part of a broader politics where we say everybody deserves to live in safety and freedom, where we take some risks together to stand up for the children of Gaza, to stand up for hostage families, to have a place where Jews and Muslims and Israelis and Palestinians could come together and say there is no military solution. The only way forward is through mutual recognition and understanding. So thank you guys very much. Out of that dark.
There's an interesting profile of Lander. I think it was in the New York Magazine that is worth reading just to get a sense of, like, the decision he made to cross endorse and to, in many respects, say, acknowledge, like, I'm not going to win. And how there was some, you know, I don't want to say reluctance, but there was some reluctance, and how surprised he was by how, by both the response that he got from voters. And I think that he felt in himself to be part of a coalition. It's pretty impressive. Here is Zoran Mamdani and Michael Brune at Bayo, which is it's a concert. But like it's a show. What is it like?
It was like a Haitian Afro-Caribbean live music experience hosted by a guy named Michael Brune.
It's like a Brune. It's like a it's like a festival of sorts
in Barclays.
Yeah, and it seems like people were pretty excited to see him there. I mean, that's going to be a big deal in this city when they roll back TPS. significant Haitian population, obviously, in New York City, and how much the city is going to cooperate as suddenly you have a significant larger population of undocumented immigrants in the city. In the event that they don't go back.
The stories out of L.A. are absolutely horrifying. The types of disappearances and stuff we're seeing. And yeah.
Horrible. I would like to see Mamdani actually sing there. I've been checking out Mr. Cardamom.
Mr. Cardamom coming back? He should, because he's been, I think, Lil Cardamom or Young Cardamom, and Mr. Cardamom, he should go by Mayor Cardamom now.
Yeah, exactly. I found this fascinating, particularly in the wake of the controversy or the questioning of Stephen Colbert when he had Mamdani and Zohran, when they had Mamdani and Lander on the program two nights before the election, about a week ago. I guess the night before the election, about a week ago, he had on Clarissa Ward, correspondent with CNN, and it's fascinating where this information goes. Like, I don't even know if you get this on CNN, but again, this is really, I love seeing this on this outlet because you're hitting a lot of people who do not follow this kind of reporting either on purpose or simply because they're not interested in it. And it's interesting to see this word going out. I mean, you have at least 75 Palestinians killed by Israeli bombing of Gaza. The food situation is incredibly dire. Play this clip.
Correspondent live via satellite from Jordan, Clarissa Ward. You've done extensive reporting from the Middle East for years. Do you have a sense of how that region now views the United States? Because this is an unprecedented military action by the United States. While we've had tension with Iran for all these years, we've never bombed them.
Right. I think there was a moment, when Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Trump were kind of dangling this idea of regime change. That is anathema to people in this region. They remember the invasion of Iraq. They remember the hundreds of thousands of people and the wave of terror and sectarianism and chaos that was unleashed as a result of that. So absolutely, that's abhorrent for people to hear in this region. But honestly, Iran is not the big issue right now in this region with America. Gaza is what is tearing people apart, is what is fueling hatred. I cannot even tell you. Every day people come up to me, Stephen, and they say, are they not seeing what we're seeing? Are they not seeing this moonscape? Are they not seeing tens of thousands killed, children starved, the largest cohort of child amputees in the history of modern warfare? Are they not seeing this? And it has eroded their faith in international institutions, in international humanitarian law, and in any notion that the U.S. is some kind of a guiding light or a beacon of human rights. And that really is a far more animating issue to most people in the Middle East right now than this latest issue, a round of hostilities with Iran.
I assume not simply because the United States is not living up to its principles of human rights, but because we're overtly supporting the Israeli military and giving them the equipment they need to carry out this military action in Gaza.
We're paying for the weapons and we're giving them cover. And that is something that people really in this region cannot get their head around, cannot forgive, and cannot fathom.
What is the latest on the ongoing hunger in Gaza?
Well, the UN has been saying for some time now, we are approaching a man-made famine. We did a story on CNN the other day of a little boy in such frustration that he was putting fistfuls of sand into his mouth and screaming at the camera. We are talking about hundreds of people being mowed down, making the 8-hour hike to try to get food from these aid distributions. We've crossed the Rubicon here. And that's not my opinion. That is a statement of fact based on everything I am seeing every single day. And the one hope that people have right now is that maybe now, on the back of this ceasefire, maybe now that Prime Minister Netanyahu has kind of flexed his muscles to the more right-wing members or the far right of his cabinet, maybe now there is a space to have a ceasefire in Gaza, to get those hostages home. And by the way, the families of those hostages as well were out imploring Israel's leadership just yesterday, saying, please, don't just make this a ceasefire for Israel and Iran. Include Gaza in it. And we heard President Trump today, too, saying he's hopeful, there's a chance, and in the next few days, we'll see if there really will be some possibility of a ceasefire in Gaza.
Clarissa, thanks so much for joining us. I hope you...
I mean, that seemed to go a little differently than one would anticipate. Brought on to talk about Iran. We should say this is in the wake of the reporting by Haaretz that Israeli soldiers were ordered to fire upon Palestinians who were coming for food aid. No suspicion of armed fighters amongst them, just fire on them. This is coming in the wake of Israeli reporting that they were putting like oxy in the flour or something. I mean, this is just full out and out barbarism. It's just it's disgusting. And one wonders, will we hear Kristen Gillibrand accuse that reporter of anti-Semitism? Will we hear the ADL accuse Colbert and that reporter of anti-Semitism? Will Congressman Dan Goldman accuse them of anti-Semitism? What about Senator Schumer? Where are the accusations of anti-Semitism? I mean, it's insanity. It's insanity.
Get to that after the problematic slogans block.
Let's take phone calls for a half an hour. 646-257-3920 is the number. 646-257-3920 is the number. Speaking of accusing Hamdani of being a potential danger to Jews in New York City, here is Mamdani responding to Kristen Gillibrand, and we should also say to other conservatives too, folks like Charlie Kirk, I mean, on and on, saying that he was just the sheer Islamophobia was crazy.
I have to ask you, too, about what it's been like for you to process some of the Islamophobic responses that we've seen. I think some would say they're not as surprised by some, like, you know, Representative Ogles saying you should be deported. But others have been a bit surprised by, for example, a New York senator going on a popular radio show and suggesting that you support global jihad. What has that been like for you? And have you had the chance to speak with Senator Gillibrand?
You know, I spoke to Senator Gillibrand soon after the victory on Tuesday evening, and the comments that I've heard, especially from Republicans across the country, and even the comments prior during the primary, were comments that were both unsurprising and yet still quite sad, because they showcase what politics has become for so many. It's a language of darkness and a language of exclusion. And what has kept me hopeful through this is that our vision is one where every New Yorker belongs, And there are so many New Yorkers who previously hadn't voted in primaries who saw themselves now in this politics, saw their struggles in our policies, and took that step to actually cast a ballot. And what excites me is that there are moments where someone will cast a ballot for someone with an exclusionary vision like Donald Trump, and they can still come back to the Democratic Party. And so many of our victories were in neighborhoods that went for Donald Trump in the presidential election. We're talking about College Point or Diker Heights, so many of the same places we were told that we had now lost voters forever. And instead, what we've found is that if you have a relentless focus on an economic agenda and you welcome people back and you turn the political instinct from lecturing to listening, you can still have people come home to the Democratic Party as long as you show them that's a party that will fight for working people, not those that are benefiting off the struggles of working people.
We are going to dig into some of your policies.
I mean, that is so good. It's nuts.
It's crazy.
Isn't it? It's nuts.
He makes him look so small.
It's unbelievable. Put up that graph of, put up number 9. This is stunning. This graph is crazy. It shows the, you got it?
Yeah, 1 second here.
This graph shows, the age demographic between 2021 primary and the 2025 primary. It really is crazy. If you'll notice here, 18 to 24, the vast majority of those people would not have voted, weren't even eligible to vote. So they're almost all new people. It's basically flipped from 2021, but it is still stunning to see.
Seems like some of the so-called prayers have been answered about how to reach some of these folks. The question is, do people like Chuck Schumer and Hakeem Jeffries want to listen to that?
Well, Mamdani is the left's Joe Rogan.
I mean, I'd rather take a mayor than a podcaster, but okay.
Well, maybe what we'll do is just give him a podcast. I mean, those numbers are amazing. I mean, he's an incredible talent.
I mean, that's why it was such a surprise on election night, right? Like, the pollsters probably weren't expecting that many 18 to 24-year-olds to turn out.
I mean, that is what, we were saying before the election. It's like, you can't really, when you have a campaign like this, you can't assume, and it's a primary and it's June. I mean, all the things. But of course, the 2021 primary was in June too. When you have a candidate who is looking to mobilize people, like that's what that's like inherent in their ideology. Is the idea that the power emanates from people. When you have a candidate like that, you can't really anticipate what it's hard to model who the electorate's going to be. And people did a bad job of that. I mean, I guess the PPP did okay.
I mean, we love those guys, yep.
But, I mean, he's also an amazing politician. Let's go to the phones. You called me in, right?
Okay. Yep.
Calling from a 316 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, is this me?
It is you. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
My name is Max Lefty. I'm calling from Wisconsin.
Max Lefty from Wisconsin. Welcome to the program, Max.
Okay, I just wanted to, I have, I work, I don't want to be like, say like exactly where I work.
Okay.
But I work for a company that sells groceries, and I work in like, I'm a buyer, and so I was looking at prices from 2019 to 2024 to just kind of like compare how much money was made and how many units were sold. that makes kind of makes sense. So just like for like for like an idea of how much we sell groceries, in 2024 we sold 230 million units of items. And so I was looking at like the units. Our units only increased 4% from that time, but our sales dollars increased by like 34%, and our margin totals increased by 89% in that time.
Wow. So,
that means a lot to you, but yeah.
I'm not sure. I mean, all of it, I'd have to see it slow, but that means like the margins increasing means that the increase in the cost of the food is not a function of how much it costs to produce it.
Exactly. If 40% increase for the vendors, what the vendors are charging us increased 40%, what we are charging the customers increased 89%.
That's
I'm telling you, we don't charge like we comp. I won't say where I work, but we comp just like Walmart. We just like make sure that our prices are around that price. So it's not just because we are specifically being greedy. Like I do the pricing for 2024. I made sure that my prices were matching every retailer. I mean, I'm very liberal with it. I try to make sure that if there's anyone that's even close, I go down because I want our customers to buy as cheap as possible. But still, even. And I wasn't in charge in 2019, but like taking that in consideration, like other retailers are also this exact same thing is happening.
And there's no reason to believe that the cost of their wholesale costs are any greater significantly than yours.
No.
So if you're matching the pricing, if you're matching the pricing and you're marking up the markup is that much larger than it was 4 years ago. There's every reason to believe that all the other markets are doing the same.
Yes. Yes. And that I am being pushed by my managers. Like why I still look into it is because they're like, we're not making enough margin percent. And I'm like, it feels like we're making way more than we used to. And I look and I'm like, historically we are actually making significantly more than we used to making groceries. And,
are there any other inputs that could be more, that could have, increased to justify that markup? In other words, like
we could have sold a lot higher dollar items. So the items could have cost like they could have like cost us, and it could have cost the, like instead of selling a small bag of M&Ms, we could have sold a big bag of M&Ms. And so it would have been higher in that way. But for our selection, what our selection is in line, it has not changed enough to where that could be the cost.
So, would you say that this is a story of greedflation?
Yes, I would say this is like an exact example of greedflation and why, you know, city-run grocery stores would be, I think Mondani really, like, as somebody who works in this field, it would, like, I just think it'd be really beneficial for people that are in food deserts, especially in food deserts, because we're not like a regular grocery store. We are, like, we sell groceries on top of the other stuff that we sell. And for some places, their only food place they can buy from, though. And we try to be, like I said, I try to make sure that our prices, I can be as competitive as possible, and I make as little money as I'm allowed to. But it's definitely, like, the 23% that we have in margin, that amount, you know, kind of goes away with a grocery store. Now they have higher labor, and they probably have higher costs, even though they shouldn't. No one really follows that costing rule. But yeah, so I really do think that prices could go down like at least 10 to 15% easily with without the profit motive increasing the team member labor, because our team member labor is very small.
Well, and I will also say that one of the theories is that you not only get lower prices for the grocery stores you operate, but you end up finding what the true cost of goods are relative to, because one of the problems that we have is that independent grocers do not have the buying power of, say, a Walmart or a big chain grocery store.
Exactly.
And
yes.
These kind of grocers get beat up, makes it harder for them to compete. The city is going to demand actually more fair pricing And then once that price becomes discoverable, it's going to be very difficult to maintain that price, a different pricing tier for a, you know, Walmart or a chain store versus an independent grocer. So this is going to have, it's going to impact almost like in the same way that a union will increase the pay across an industry. Having a municipal owned grocery store is going to impact pricing across grocery stores, and it's going to go down. But it also, you know, leads me to believe that, you know, there's no reason to assume that one state in, the Midwest, the grocers all decided that we're going to increase our profit margins exponentially, and no one else did that across the country. I find that very hard to believe.
I'm telling you, part of my job is looking at other people's prices, and we are exactly in line. And we aren't a regular grocery store. We don't have the Walmart pricing. We have pretty good pricing, but we don't have the Walmart pricing. So if Walmart's is just higher, Walmart's margins, because I'm matching their exact prices. You know, like we're matching that exact price.
And Walmart has the buying power that there's no way they're paying more for stuff than anybody else.
Well, Lena Khan was suing them and Pepsi, and then fucking Trump's FTC dropped the charges recently.
Oh, well, that's not because of any donations to the inaugural ball.
No,
if that's
couldn't
what you're,
be. Couldn't.
No, no way.
It couldn't be. Okay, I'm sorry, one more thing. I just wanted to say that you guys did inspire me to go to a local meeting, and I have decided to join like two or three. There's actually two regular Dem parties. There's Invisible and like our local Dem party, and then they're starting a youth one. And technically, I'm still at the age of the youth, so I think I'm going to join all three of them. And you guys have really just inspired me to get involved, especially Mondani. So I just thank you so much. Long time, first time. So I was really nervous when I first started. Cars. So
give
sorry,
me one
I
of these.
So weird. Oh my gosh.
But also, I really appreciate your calling in. I mean, because that story is fascinating, and it really, I think, is indicative of something that's been going on that's been obscured in many, many respects. Appreciate the call.
Yeah.
You know.
Thank you.
Just to tail on that, Sam, I've been looking at. I lived in Minnesota for a while. I didn't know that they had municipal liquor stores so regularly, and so I went on Google Maps. And if you just scan over some of these, there's not a single municipal liquor store that gets under like a. They're all 4-star ratings at least. People love
the government
things.
Can't do anything. Didn't you know that, Matt? The government can't do anything.
It can sell booze in Minnesota. I can tell you that 4.4. 4.7, like these are all extremely well-reviewed liquor stores. It's unbelievable. It's 4.5. People just love their city-owned liquor stores in Minnesota.
I think, isn't it also New Hampshire?
Yeah, New Hampshire, the Red Barn liquor stores.
Oh, well, yeah, I know either. That was your family outing growing up, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was every spring break.
Every Sunday. We got to drive to New Hampshire. All the liquor stores are closed everywhere else in New England. We got to go to New Hampshire.
But Tim Pool says it will drive out small businesses. So who knows what's going to happen?
It's actually going to help small businesses. First off, you're not going to open a supermarket in an area where there isn't a need for a supermarket. And then what it's going to do, like this call verifies for us, it is going to start to put pressure on getting fair pricing for a lot of these small outfits, whether they're bodegas or small grocery stores, independent grocery stores. And the other thing that I think is also pretty obvious is that when you have a grocery store, it is sort of like the bedrock of a neighborhood. People, if you have a place that is going to be attracting a critical mass of people because everybody wants to go to the grocery store because everybody's eating, then all of a sudden it gives opportunities for other businesses in the neighborhood that gets built around the grocery store. calling from a 201 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, can you hear me?
Yep.
Hi, I'm Benny. I'm from New Jersey.
Benny from New Jersey. What's on your mind?
From right across the Hudson. And I was very excited about the results from the mayoral election in New York. But right before that, we had our gubernatorial election in New Jersey. And to me, it was kind of weird seeing how it felt like a sort of mirror universe image of what happened in New York, where because we had first passed the poll, we had two progressive candidates splitting the vote. We had Ross Baraka and Steve Fulop. And Mikey Sherrill ended up winning. And, I mean, the landslide Mamdani got really took me by surprise. And I was wondering what your thoughts were about, like, what the outcome in New Jersey might have been had we had ranked choice. Because, actually, I know a friend of mine was going to vote for Fulop, but he ended up voting for Mikey Sherrill because polling had told him that she was going to win, and he didn't want Gottheimer to win. Right. So he cast his vote for her. Just another aspect of it is wondering if in first past the poll, polling almost becomes kind of like a self-fulfilling prophecy where you're told, don't waste your vote, so just vote for whoever has the best chance.
Listen. The if you look back on ranked choice voting in 2021, it ended up, in some respects, biting progressives in the ass. It really, what needs to happen is, and I think ranked choice voting is better. I just do. I think it's helpful. But what needs to happen is there has to be a sufficient amount of education by the candidates. And there needs to be models. Like, I mean, look, Brad Lander, let's say it was just a straight on non-ranked choice voting. You know, Mamdani still probably, I mean, he won in the first round. He could have won. We don't know how much Lander's endorsement contributed to that, the Cross endorsement. But Lander's career is in such better shape than it would have been had he just come in third in a non-ranked choice voting, had there not been a Cross endorsement. I mean, I think it was very enlightening for him. And, you know, some of this credit, just from the reporting I know, I don't know anything other than what I've read in this instance. When there were complaints about AOC not endorsing, one of the things that came out of the reporting was that she and her people were admonishing the progressive candidates, like, you guys got to get your act together and figure out how we don't end up splitting the vote like it did last time. Like, you need to educate people about ranked choice voting, and you need to have a plan on how you're going to beat Cuomo. Which, you know, meant that people who, you know, for Brad Lander, it was basically conceding on some level that he wasn't going to win. And he wasn't going to win this election. But for people whose ideology are more important, and not just, you know, ideology in the most limited sense, but like vision for the city in this instance, or the state, or our politics, For people who put that first, it becomes an easier decision to sort of say, like, I'm going to stay in this race, but I'm going to lose this race. But I'm going to help what I want, the closest thing I want to win. And so, you know, what we ended up getting was more of like a parliamentary type of style of election because of the ranked choice voting. And it created a coalition that I think, like, from a governing standpoint, the best shot that Mamdani has of success is going to come from having this type of coalitional politics. And so I don't know how it played out in New Jersey, but I'm in favor of ranked choice voting because it definitely rewards coalition building projects. And, you know, leftist candidates, coalition building, organizing is endemic to their politics in a way that it's not for candidates as you move further away from the left towards the center and the right.
I mean, I'll just say, I think, I'm sorry.
No, go ahead.
I'll just say one of the reasons I think Cuomo really kneecapped himself in the election was he didn't seem to take any advantage of ranked choice. He didn't try to build a coalition at all.
Oh, he didn't he just seem ran, to like, try to do anything.
I mean, Ramos endorsed him, and he's like, I appreciate her for that. I will not be cross-endorsing.
I mean, it's just, it's indicative of, listen, I mean, this is like, there is a second order reflection of a person's ideology as a candidate. This is, you know, not always the case, but overwhelmingly so. Cuomo lives in a world where the expenditure of money is the way that you do things in terms of building a politics. It's all money based. It's all transactional. And so when his consultants come to him and say, this is what you got to do. You got to raise $30 million or you got to rely on those outside expenditures. They're going to buy television ads and you're just going to blanket it. You're going to blanket it. And it's because all the other people who are suggesting this to him are also making a tremendous amount of money from that. I mean, the consultants who bought those media buys over the course of whatever it has been, 4 or 5 months, they pocketed like $2 million. $2 million on just the media buys, maybe more. And so you surround yourself with these people, they all have an agenda, and that is to make cash. And so, I mean, that's why these type of campaigns, you know, and whereas like Mamdani's whole ideology, he can't do it without people. And so it forces a candidate like that to forge coalitions, to organize people, et cetera, et cetera. Appreciate the call.
Thank you.
All right. I think we are sadly done with calls for today. Let's see here. And then we'll finish up with a couple IMs and wrap this baby up. I can't. Oh, there we go. That sound suggests that there will be no more calls. Vinny from Buffalo. I think the establishment's going to get Adams to drop out early when he's at less than 10%, and Silva is going to get offered a job at Fox News as a bribe for dropping out. And then what, Cuomo? It doesn't look like Cuomo's even campaigning.
I mean, that's what's so amazing about the nature of the victory is that if it would be one thing if Cuomo was leading until like the eighth round, but who wants to throw money into his coffers right now?
Nobody. Buckets of buckets. Sam, the grocery store, which probably isn't going to happen, isn't going to be competing with Wegmans. I would disagree that it's going to happen or not, but of course it's not going to be competing with Wegmans. Did you not listen to anything over that last call at all? Like literally nothing? It's going to be placed, these grocery stores are going to go into neighborhoods that are underserved, that don't have a Wegmans. That's the whole point.
There's two not, Wegmans in NYC, like, and they're in the richest places.
He's not looking to compete with other stores. The value of it in terms of what it does for the market is that it is price discovery. It is price discovery. We have a problem that maybe, I don't know if Wegmans is one of those, but certainly, like, you know, big chain grocery stores have some monopsony power in terms of the way they buy. And they have deals where they get the lowest price. These are anti-competitive pricing structures. The city is not going to have that problem. They're going to get, we got to get best prices in the city. They're going to push for that. And then that information is going to be a lot more readily available. And they, you could see the state attorney general bringing suits on that type of pricing.
Seal, I get a lot of response from folks who are like, actually, grocery stores aren't even that profitable. And it's like, that's the point. They're not that profitable, and they don't serve a lot of people, not only in food deserts in New York City, but also in rural areas, because you can't leave it up to profiteers to get groceries to people.
Yep. Alex from Rhode Island, what do I say to my Dem senators about the bill when I call? Continue to fight. Keep the Voterama on as long as possible.
Mention anti-ICE stuff too.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know that there's any Democratic senators that need to be convinced, but it's always good to, if they know that you're engaging in this stuff and you're mad about it, you know. It's teaching them a lesson about what the priorities are of their constituents. That's helpful. Sam, did you see the report on Democratic state strategizing about potentially withholding money that goes to the Fed? Any way something like this could even work? I'm not even sure. I have no idea. I haven't heard anything about that. Kowalski from Nebraska, grocery stores are a mature business, and in a capitalist mode of production, that means they are not valuable anymore. Grocery store should be treated as a public utility and run as such. Kansas shows that that model can work.
That's a farmer, everybody.
What do they know about food? Be Money CPA, New York City budget looks like it's going to include funds for a pilot of childcare for children younger than three. This is excellent news. Well, exciting.
If you're a communist or a parent.
Or a parent. Communist parents.
Loving it.
Milo Dangle Bilo. What's the number one spice, Sam? Is it better than fish? Is it better with rice? Sam, did you remember to pray this morning? We're living under an Islamist Leninism now. I'll tell you something. Very difficult walking around New York City now. They're already starting to put up the no-go zones. You literally have to go underground into a tram that they provide, like a underground railway, if you will, to avoid some of the parts of New York City that are no-go as for pedestrians. Stephen Miller Shadow, the CDC is in the pocket of big pestilence. Vermont Ben, I think it would be good to have a Ukrainian journalist on the show to discuss the situation there. It's getting worse, and now that Trump has quit on ending the conflict, seems no one cares about Ukrainian civilian suffering. Yeah, we should check in with that as well. It's really... Ukraine was hit by the largest drone track of the war on Saturday night, including in western regions like Lviv. Nearly 10% of Russian drones fired at Ukraine during the war were launched in June of 2025. Wow. The Russian economy is in, I've been reading, is in dire straits. And so you're going to see more desperation and from Russia in that regard. We should look for somebody over the next week or two. Nassau County needs some primaries for Gillen and Swazi. These people are some of the worst, says Nassau County spokesperson. All right, five more. Scary Carrie, I love bolo ties. I wore one in the 90s. We got to find out if that was a bolo tie.
Definitely, I think, right? Yeah. My dad's a big bolo tie guy.
Kentucky boy. Trickle down is something preschoolers only understand as something throwing up on the slide. They can't fathom the intricate artistry at play. Scribbling dollars on the back of a napkin. That's where the Laffer curve was first theorized. Autumn. I think it's cool that history has horseshoed around to having an infallible empire. That is, I don't quite get that. Swing state. The new American Revolution will be bloodless if the left allows it. Greg from the Berg. On Gaza, I was hesitant to be entirely behind the movement because of how much spin surrounds this kind of issue. Then I saw the videos and the photos. My heart broke at seeing all the devastation, the corpses of children, and I'll be the judge of our government until the day they are replaced. And it'll be what I judge of our current government until they're replaced. Left is best. I'm trying, Sam, but I can only call Fetterman a bald-headed traitor scum so many times. All right, two more. 502 Drew. I'm not going to say what grocery chain I work for, but it starts with a K and rhymes with Broger. And the final I am of the day. Based on what I've learned about the Fetterman's family life and recently, I'm sure the beach day was much more enjoyable for his family in his absence. Yeah. All right, folks. Matt, Brian, Emma on honeymoon. Great job today. Folks, we'll see you tomorrow.
It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want. But I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in. And my pilot somewhere the choice is made for the option where you don't get paid for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my drive.